I don't know about you, but I feel like in our present reality today, this season, this era, this spot on the historical timeline that we're living in, I find that it is quite easy to either offend or to be offended. And it is particularly challenging if you embody a role similar to the one that I embody in a place where from time to time or on the regular, you make public or semi-public commentary in groups of large people. Like the amount of energy that it takes to not offend is substantial. And so this morning I'll make just a different choice, and rather not to offend, I will just aspire to offend you all with my remarks. So let me say to those of you in the room who would identify as thinkers, if you primarily approach life through thought and thinking your way through the issues that we face, the good news is that the sermon that I intend to preach this morning is a sermon that is based on existentialism and ontology. It's born out of Aristotle's sense of orthoparahoresis, or the fancy word for like right intention. And I intend to preach a sermon that will help you think your way through this reality, where I will either disappoint you or even offend you, is that I'm going to do that by telling you a story, not creating an argument or an apologetic that we can assess with our rational minds. And to those of you who are feelers, well, the good news is that I'm going to tell you a story. And you feelers, you love a story. I know how that goes because that's my orientation. I'm a feeler. The bad news is where you will be disappointed and maybe even offended is I'm going to tell you a broader version of the story that Christy just read out of our gospel. And that story is apocalyptic. It's violent, it's confusing, it's fearful, it demands a lot from our hearts. And you feelers, you like stories, but only the ones that are warm and fuzzy. And the story that I intend to tell is not a warm and fuzzy one. It's an important one, but it's not a warm and fuzzy one. And just a minute about story itself before we really launch into the meat today. I want to tell you that if you've been in this church week after week, you know I am animated by story. And I'm particularly animated by the story from the biblical text. I'm particularly animated by sacred story. Any sacred story feeds my soul, but I'm particularly attached, which should come as no surprise, to the Jewish Christian story and the story that we get from the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures, or from the Old Testament and from the New Testament. But what I want to be clear when it comes to story is that our orientation to the story is not like plot fluency. It's not that we're just like meant to grasp the beats of the story and sort of understand of like, oh, I know what comes next. The virgin bride gives birth to a child in a manger. That's what happens next. No, I think when it comes to story, we're meant to have a relationship with the story. And just as any human relationship changes over time, our relationship to the story itself should change over time. As we grow and change, the story grows and changes. I don't mean that the words in the story necessarily grows, like changes. The words are the same, and the trajectory tends to be somewhat the same, but the way that the story lands in us is different. It just is. And if you haven't experienced that difference yet, I would invite you to just like approach story with a little more openness and a little more softness, rather than like, oh yeah, I remember this. Oh yeah, okay, that's what comes next. Okay, got it. It's all locked in. Like, don't come to Christmas or Easter just going like, nothing really new here. I know how it goes. It's like, no. This word is living word, and we have a relationship with this story. And in all transparency, I will tell you that I, at this phase in my life, have a very different orientation to apocalyptic literature that I had in the first half of my life. The first half of my life, I spent a lot of time like scratching my head about these kind of scary stories that are told in the apocalyptic genre of like, wait a minute, like, I thought, Jimmy, you preached to your people and you felt in your heart week after week that God is a God of love. And yet this story feels violent and destructive and disruptive in our lives. And what I can say to you is that I was really trying to attach myself to those stories in the physical world, in where we're grounded here day to day in our human relationships. But the apocalyptic genre speaks to the metaphysical life. And as I have had an opening of my own metaphysical life in a fairly profound way over the course of the last several beats of my life, I'm like, oh, this is why those stories are here. And then when you, after that moment of surprise, we get to that place where you're like, you know, after the, oh, this is why these stories here, you're like, oh, thank God. Thank God there are stories like these that can explain some of the confusion that I have as a being who is both physical and metaphysical, but spends the majority of my life in the physical world. This is a beautiful window. So I just invite, when it comes to this story, if you are feelers in particular, but all of you, that you just have a measure of openness to the story itself. Cool? Are we cool? Cool enough. We're cool right now, but I'm about to offend you all. So one of the things that we have to ask ourselves, particularly as we are delivered these snippets of stories within the context of this tool that we have called the lectionary, which is basically just a calendar of readings, we have to ask ourselves, when we're studying these snippets, we have to ask ourselves, where does the story really begin? And I can tell you metaphysically, it begins in the manger or even the garden, but like not, we got to narrow it down a little closer than that. So when I ask myself, okay, where does this particular wars and rumors of wars, confounding and somewhat disruptive story begin? It really begins in the 20th chapter of Luke. So the installment that we have is from the first beat of the 21st chapter of Luke. So we have to back up really to get the trajectory of what Jesus is trying to teach us, or what Jesus is trying to share with us, or what Jesus is trying to lead us into or out into. We have to go back to Luke 20. Luke 20 opens up with Jesus preaching in the temple. Now, it's not something that only happens once in the Gospels. Jesus is a rabbi. He's an eccentric rabbi, one who is not credentialed through institutional process, but he's a rabbi nevertheless, and he oftentimes preaches in the temple or in these local synagogues. And there's almost always this curious thing that happens where the story will tell you, like, man, Jesus just preached the greatest sermon that any of us has ever heard. And then like two sentences later, the Pharisees or some other group of people are like super mad that he's there and doing that. One of those stories is so exaggerated that, like, it says, like, Jesus was such a profound teacher that he unrolled the scroll of Isaiah, and he had words to give commentary to the scroll of Isaiah that we had never heard. Our hearts were opened so profoundly, and two sentences later, they are trying to throw him off a cliff. So this is one of those stories where Jesus is preaching in the temple. And just after he preaches, though he preached either moderate, good, or great sermon, the Pharisees, and we should hear Pharisees as like the religious order. We should hear Pharisees as like people like me, people who like represent the order and authority of the institutional church that is distinguished over and against and differently from the faith, the heart of the faith itself. These Pharisees come to Jesus and they basically ask him this pretty profound existential question. How are the thinkers feeling now? You're like, all right, existential question. Yeah, so the religious authority of the day basically asked Jesus, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are standing up here in this place preaching a sermon? How do you, like, who are you to come and do this? Even though the lesson is great. And Jesus responds as he oftentimes does. Here's for my feelers in the room. He responds with a parable, with a story. He doesn't say, like, I'm the Son of the living God and I'm about to torch you guys. He says, let me tell you a story about who I am. And it's that parable of the wicked tenants. If you remember that parable, it's like there was a landowner who had a giant farm, and he had to leave town or leave the country. And so he went to his staff, his senior staff, and he said, like, hey, guys, like, I'm getting called away to this place. Maybe he was going to be an ambassador or something like that. And, like, I'm entrusting all this resource to you guys, and I expect you to do a good job and really to make something of this place while I'm gone. Are we in? And they're like, oh, yeah, man, we are in. We got this thing. Go be the ambassador in Hong Kong. We can knock it out of the park. And then time after time after time after time again, that senior staff of the farm chooses to manage the farm in such a way that it benefits them but not the landowner. And the landowner in this moment of frustration becomes so desperate to communicate how important it is to engage in this process of good stewardship of the resources that he sends his kid. And he's like, hey, kid, like, you got to go, like, convince him. And he's like, surely these guys are going to listen to my kid. And instead, they murder him. You know, it's this profound act of violence happens and this great disappointment and just yet another fracture of human relationship. And then there's this, like, kind of comedic turn, which we had last week. So Jesus tells them a story and they're like, that feels like not great, but like, okay, so let's ask you a set of questions. We've got some questions for you, Jesus, to determine just how well-formed and how smart you are. They're trying to think their way through this institutional work, right? And so they tell a story, and it's the one that we had from last week. This story about, like, okay, so there's this woman who, like, marries this guy. And they have a pretty good relationship for a time. She never gets pregnant and has a kid. And then the guy dies. And our scriptures say, like, if the guy dies, then the brother's supposed to step in and marry her so that she can have kids. And so, you know, then the second brother steps in and marries her, and then no kids, and he dies. And then, like, so the third brother steps in, and they get married, and they have no kids. And, like, oh, like, great tragedy of tragedy. He dies too. And then four, and then five, and then six, and then seven. Seven brothers. This woman marries seven brothers, has no kids. The seventh brother dies. The woman dies. She goes to heaven. The seven brothers are in heaven. And then, like, the religious authority, like me, they're like, okay, Mr. Jesus, Mr. Smarty Pants, like, if you're such a great rabbi, then you tell me, who is this woman's husband? And, you know, Jesus has the same reaction that we're having, where it's just like, palm to face, right? Just like, where he's just like, guys, like, please, can you invite yourself into a fuller experience of what it means to be alive? Can you somehow open your minds and your hearts to believe that heaven is a place that when we are fully absorbed into the metaphysical world, the rules of the physical world don't necessarily stand. So the questions that you are asking me are absurd. And they're so absurd that they're offensive. And they're so offensive that it shows your arrogance. And then he launches into this beautiful episode. We're like two back from where we're really getting to the story that we have today, where he says, oh, and this one hurts a little bit if you're me, where he says, like, beware of scribes, beware of clergy who walk around in church and adorn themselves in beautiful robes. I mean, he says robes, and here I am wearing one. And he says, and they utter the most eloquent prayers. You know, they talk real good too. And everybody likes them. And they get so much feedback. And their egos grow to be monsters. And then he says in this turn, he's like, you know what? If you really want to be a faithful person, if you really want to know what real living is like, you should be like this lady over here. She is an elderly widow. She doesn't have two nickels to rub together, yet she has taken two copper coins, she's taken two pennies, and she has dropped them into the offering plate out of her orientation to a world. How is it that this woman is the picture of generosity in our in the context of our community? She has next to nothing, and she is giving it all. But I tell you, it is she who is more oriented to what it means to really live than any of you other imbeciles in church listening to me this morning. And then the very next beat is this passage that we get from Jesus where he begins to talk about these apocalyptic occurrences that are so destructive. And what I would invite you to consider, particularly if you're a thinking type, you know, we read these stories and they're fear-driven and disruptive and violent. But if you approach them from the context of like me as a history major, when you're like wars and rumors of wars, you're like, oh, yeah, like life, like history, like this kind of disruption happens. And perhaps God is not inviting me to like manage it or change it or control it. If you remember, like, Jesus doses them with this very first phase of destruction where he's like, yeah, this beautiful temple that you guys did, you launched a capital campaign to build this building. You gave it. You put a bunch of fancy stuff all over the outside, and it's just going to crumble into nothing. And then the first question that comes up is like, really? When? When's it going to happen? You know, it's just like we're doing that human thing of like, how can we avoid this? How can we prevent it? How can we hold it off? And Jesus is like, well, I mean, you can't. You know, you can't do this. He is leading us to an orientation in life, to an orientation to the metaphysical side of our lives that brings us a reality where we are able to be generous even in our own poverty. It's this beautiful moment. It's an incredibly hard move for us to make. And it's somewhat, in the metaphysical world, it's somewhat of an advanced move. It's a bit postgraduate. As I was thinking about this and trying to describe like these seasons of living that human beings have, if it is a progression, it's a circular progression, but like how do we describe what happens? I would say like we must meet this woman in her poverty, and we must come to understand what she is denied and what she is gifted. And what I was dreaming up was this idea of like, just think about ourselves for a moment, somewhat ontologically and somewhat mystically. When we as human beings come into this incarnation, when we are born, out of a model of utter interdependence. As we emerge from the womb, through the birth canal, into creation itself, or into the physical world itself, there is something profound that happens. Like quite physically and literally, we sever the umbilicus. We as creatures, in the very beginning, are formed out of utter interdependence. There is no difference between you and me, I and thou. We are one until we're not. You know, I was joking around with Brian a little bit this morning as I've been praying through this sermon and thinking about the experience. You know, one of the things that came to mind is like being in the labor and delivery room, and particularly like the experience of being a dad in the labor and delivery room, which I've had. And like there's this, you know, there's this trend of like, hey, dad, like, here are the scissors. Like, come on, like, cut the umbilical cord. Like, I just had this flash of like, whoa, like, don't do that, dad. Like, that is very unadvisable. There is a karmic wound that's happening there. Like, it should not be a man who cuts the umbilical cord. It should be a woman. You hand those scissors back to your female OB-GYN or to your female labor and delivery nurse. You let her cut that. Your job as a man is just to witness. Just witness the profundity and the magnitude of birth and life emerging itself. You stay 10 feet away from those scissors. Just witness. Don't give commentary. Just witness and experience the profundity of that. We come into life in a relationship that is utterly interdependent, and then we sever the umbilicus and we fully emerge in the first moments of our breath, or of our airy breath life. We enter into a stage of what I would call independence. It's not that there's not work to do in that independent stage. There is, but it's like our spine becomes the umbilicus, right? So what our work is meant to do in that particular first half of life is our work is to connect this organ with this organ and this organ. It's the work of integration as individual human beings. We do have an individual physical expression in the world. My feet don't look like Ruth's feet or like Cindy's feet. My feet are just my feet. And this time of year, I like to hide them from you guys. Right? So there is this work that we have in the first half of life of independence, but it is integrating work. It's getting integrated here, mind, heart, gut, that's so critical to our advancement into this second half of life, which is what this widow is living in. So let's pause for a moment and let's talk about let's talk about the gift of poverty that this woman has been delivered in the physical realm, which has oriented her metaphysically to such a profound and symbolic and beautiful life. What is she denied? So on the surface, it's quite easy for us to say, like, well, she's denied resource. Like, she is a woman who is not tethered to a man because her husband has died, and she lives in the context of a very patriarchal system where there's, like, she can't go down to Loaf and Jug and get a job or to become a nurse at the hospital or a checker at the grocery store or a judge on the bench in the Teton County Courthouse. It's not an option for her. She has no choice other than to live based upon the kindness of or the support of other human beings. This woman enters the second half of life when she is forced into a relationship of interdependence. Can you see the circle that's happening here? Can you see how the return of the second half of life brings us back into a relationship with other creatures and creation in such a profound way that we live differently in the world? Most of us think about being a widow and being impoverished quite fearfully. And yet this woman moves through life with a generous equanimity that is kind of astonishing to us, those of us who are guarded and trying to make our own way. She is utterly denied the ability to physically live or even live under the delusion or the illusion that we live life independently. She is reconnected to this connected reality that begins in the garden and gets reconstituted in the chaos of the manger in a beautiful way. Jesus is telling us, and he tells us at the end of this particularly disruptive passage, you remember, he gives these scenarios where the world is just coming to an end, and everything that is important and meaningful, everything that we thought we were relying on, is coming to destruction and decomposition. And then he tells a certain part of the constituency who is listening. We don't really know who. We know the widow, if she's there in the room, is already a part of this constituency. But he says, like, as for those of you who are following my thoughts, as for those of you who are following the way that I live in this world, as those of you who are responsive to this particular kind of eccentric incarnation, as for you, not a hair on your head will be harmed. He is speaking back to that metaphysical sense that we get where we can find equanimity in the midst of chaos and destruction. I like to distinguish it using a word that comes from primarily into our culture from the recovery community. That word is serenity. It's a very profound ontological experience of equanimity. Now, to be clear, like, what's the distinction there? Well, it's not peace. I'm not praying for peace, because peace would mean, here we all are, you know, grounded. nestled, connected one to another and connected to God, and everything is fine. That is not going to happen. Serenity is about how do I find a connection with myself, a connection with the other, and a connection to God that is sustained amidst the chaos and destruction and confusion of the world. Jesus is inviting us in to this very different experience. And for the most part, you know, like honestly, it's kind of like postgraduate work for the human being. Like not all of us get there, and not all of us are really inclined to be there. This second half of life living, and I don't mean to say like it comes that if we do the math, like 38 or something, like you can be in the second half of life as a 25-year-old. But what I would also say is, if you are in the second half of life as a 25-year-old, I would say, there, there, dear heart. Because the only way that you come to the second half of life as a 25-year-old is through trauma. It's just a reality. And then there are those of us who live with small or moderate doses of trauma, and we emerge into the second half of life, if we do at all, in our 40s or our 50s, and sometimes that's described as a crisis. Perhaps it's like a welcome crisis. You know, we know that internally. Or perhaps it's like our resistance of like, I like the first half of life, and I don't want to be moved on into the second half of life. But the cosmos is up there reorienting you, re-upsetting you, turning you up so upside down that you're like kind of forced into that place. So Jesus is inviting us to live in this kind of integrated metaphysical, physical reality. Okay, one more beat of this sermon and then I'll sit down, I promise. And this is maybe the most important beat of the sermon. I can't stand when preachers or spiritual teachers or like folks who are delivering like kerygma or dharma say things like, well, like, oh, like, yeah, it's just about like non-attachment. Or, oh, yeah, it's just about like welcoming suffering into your life. Or, oh, it's just about like finding peace and equanimity in the world. That like that's how you should live. And like, and then they like say amen and sit down. Because we are like, wait, how? How do you do that? Like, so if we're inclined, you know, toward this like new way of living that Jesus is embodying, how do we do it? Well, that's where we get this list of spiritual disciplines. But it's a reconstituted, reoriented, reinterpreted list. Because you all have that list, but right now it's just a to-do list, right? It's just like, well, I should have some way that I serve, that I do community service. And I should be generous, and I should be nurturing, and I should be caring. No, no, it's not, that is not the orientation. It's like, here I find myself on the threshold of the first half of life to the second half of life, and I need some tools that will reorient me to that. What are those tools? They are spiritual disciplines. This is where, on the private and personal side, we get quiet. We pray. We meditate. We like invite ourselves into the presence of God, who we barely know in our minds, but for some reason, like our soul knows God so well. And so we engage in these spiritual traditions so that we might slowly, gradually, over time, we might know to trust what our soul knows. And then there are other ways to do it too. Like maybe you make a meal for someone. Say, say a friend of yours is sick. Say they have COVID. And they can't go to the grocery store because they have the plague and they also feel terrible and they're stuck at home. And you're like, I'm going to make you some chicken soup. This orientation that we have to service is like, while you peel those carrots, you think loving, healing, kind thoughts of those people. And as you drop the onion into the stock pot, you heap loving energy onto this person. And as the chicken is submerged into the broth, you invite them to be covered in equanimity and peace in the midst of feeling so physically down and degraded and decomposing. And then when you deliver that soup to them and you hand it over, you look them in the eye and you tell them, like, hey, I'm really thinking about you. I'm really praying for you. I am engaged in the experience of your physical body healing in this moment in time. It can be something as simple as like just holding a hand. You know, I just qualified it with just, like, just holding a hand. Like, this is such a powerful practice as human beings. I mean, here's Ruth. I'm holding Ruth's hand. It's so much warmer than mine. But I'm also holding Ruth's hand, and I know, like, Ruth is leaving today. We're not going to see Ruth until the fall. Like this is sweet. I'm going to put her hand on my heart. I'm going to say how important you are, Ruth. Like, oh, we're going to miss you. We're going to miss your physical presence, and we know that your metaphysical presence is going to be with us. That orientation to connection that is so profound. And hey, like, if you want the real experience, if you want the real life-changing experience of holding someone's hand that changes you, you hold the hand of someone you love who is dying. Or you hold the hand of the body of someone you love who has died. I mean, if that experience does not change you, you have a heart of stone that only God can turn to flesh. These are the transformative moments that we experience that reorient us in a way, one to another, that is profound. I want you to rewild, to reconstitute the way that you are living in the world. You know, we try to do this here on Sunday morning with this table here, but this is a bit calcified, right? You know, one of the beautiful beats about this story itself, like what we get from this story, this is kind of like if the play that we're in is a three-act play and each act has three scenes in it, the play that we're in is like act two, scene three. The very next chapter, the very next chapter that we get in Luke's story is act three, scene one. Act three, scene one is like, hey guys, I'm going to die. I'm going to be murdered. I'm going to be murdered for living the way that I live and for showing you how to live. And then act three, scene two, act three, scene two, Jesus says, like, this is it, guys. I'm going down. I'm going to die. This is terrible. Scene two, act three, what does he do? Do you remember? What does he do? He throws a dinner party. He throws a dinner party and he says, like, hey, if you want to know how to really live, you do it around a table. You do it in this sharing economy that happens across the table, that is a feast. And it's a feast even. There are only crackers and wine on the table. It's still a feast. This is what the widow knows. It's still a feast. And as I was trying to think about preaching this sermon, I was like, well, what's the different way that you would go to a meal? Like, what's the non-profound, like, only physical way? And I was like, oh, I got it. It's brunch. Brunch, fun, right? Brunch, fun, shallow. It's a shallow experience. Brunch is not deep. Like, there could be wine on the table, but it's not like wine that turns to blood. It's not wine that gives you life. It's just an intoxicating and numbing substance, which just keeps the brunch experience low. You know, it's even like efficient, right? And nothing in the metaphysical world is efficient. Brunch is so, it's like, it's not breakfast, it's not lunch. I kind of kill two birds with one stone. Boom, we're done. I can go out for golf or a hike or a ski. Like, that's it. Like, well, here's what I can tell you. If you are trying in earnest to live this life of faith that Jesus is inviting you to live, that so many of us are trying to figure out, that so many of us are trying to lean toward, then don't do brunch. Do a feast. Do a meal where you share what you're afraid of and you share what blessings have come into your life and you share everything in between. We are working our way back toward one another. It can happen in just the human connection of the holding of a hand or a long walk along the dike with someone who needs to be listened to. It is not rocket science. It is not. It is simple, but it is not easy. Church. Most of us aren't going to do this. And that's okay. Like, we still sit in the hand of an unfailingly competent, holy, devoted God who loves you no matter what. And if you are inclined to live the life that Jesus lives and that he embodies through his teaching, that I have such a strong desire to live in my own life, that I try to lean toward and teach toward. If you have a desire to live that life in earnest, you have found yourselves in the right place. You are not alone in a reality that can feel challenging and hard and sometimes lonely. You are not alone. You are exactly where you need to be. And how lucky are we in our ironic poverty to find ourselves here in this place. Amen. Amen. What Ruth said. Did you see? She just finished my sermon for me.